I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. Happy New Year. It's January 4th, and we have a lot to talk about. We're 4 days into a new year, and that means there are a lot of people who are 4 days into a new diet, 4 days into a new exercise regimen, or 4 days into some other life-changing behavior. It also means that despite the very best of intentions, most of these lifestyle changes will become distant memories by March. But it doesn't have to be that way. My guest today is Dr. Brooks Wingo, and we're talking about ways that we can change our behavior and stick to our goals throughout the year. Dr. Wingo is an associate professor at the University of Alabama, Birmingham in the Department of Occupational Therapy, and she's the principal investigator and director of the Health Behavior and Disability Lab. Now, you might be wondering why we're talking about keeping our New Year's resolutions on a podcast that's supposed to be about multiple sclerosis. Well, while the whole world may be hoping to eat healthier or exercise more in 2022, evidence shows that when people with MS make healthy lifestyle changes like quitting smoking, eating healthier, or exercising more regularly, their quality of life and even some of their MS symptoms actually improve. So while we look to disease-modifying therapies to delay MS progression and prolong your quality of life, there are things that you can do today, things that don't require a pill, injection, or infusion, and these things can have a more immediate and positive impact on your MS journey. And I think that makes this conversation with Dr. Wingo about maintaining those positive behavioral changes throughout the year an important conversation for anyone living with MS. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Brooks Wingo, there are a few other things that you should know about. As we welcome 2022, I thought we should take a moment for a look back at 2021. I think this past year can best be summed up in a single word: COVID. And in spite of what we're seeing around us right now, I'm still hopeful that 2022 isn't going to offer us a repeat performance of 2021, or 2020 for that matter. But if you remember, 2021 started on a very optimistic note. As early as January 13th, the National MS Society's panel of medical experts issued their guidance, advising people with relapsing, remitting, and progressive MS to get the COVID-19 vaccine. The panel wrote, and I'm quoting here, "The risks of COVID-19 disease outweigh any potential risks from the vaccine." Well, that statement was true then, and it's true today. And since that time, the MS Society's expert panel has continued to update their guidance as new evidence continues to come to light. And throughout 2021, new evidence continued to inform us about how COVID-19 might impact someone living with MS. If we think back to April of 2020, literally just weeks after we recognized the threat of COVID-19, the National MS Society and the Consortium of MS Centers joined forces to create COVI-MS, a North American database designed to capture information about outcomes for people with MS who had developed COVID-19. And in 2021, at the Consortium of MS Centers annual meeting, Dr. Ann Cross reported some of the things that researchers were learning from the data on 3,452 patients that made up the COVI-MS database. Researchers discovered that disabled people who were living with MS faced much greater risks from contracting COVID-19. They discovered that of non-ambulatory patients with COVID-19, 24.6% had been hospitalized, 8.3% had been in the ICU or had been ventilated, and 14% had died. The researchers contrasted that data with data that showed only 7.5% of ambulatory patients with MS who had contracted COVID-19 required hospitalization. Only 2% had been in the ICU or had been ventilated, and just over 0.5% had died. In August, a study from France showed that the antibody response to COVID-19 was actually decreased in patients on anti-CD20 drugs like Ocrevus and Rituxan. Further evidence showing this same antibody response to COVID-19 was presented in October at ECTRIMS, the largest MS research conference in the world. Also at ECTRIMS, scientists shared research that began to explain the how and the why behind this decreased antibody response in patients on anti-CD20 drugs. And all of this evidence helped neurologists better understand how to time Ocrevus infusions with COVID-19 vaccinations. 2021 was also the year that oral ponesimod, or Pombiliti, received FDA approval for treating relapsing remitting MS and active secondary progressive MS. And just last week, the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence reversed its prior ruling and recommended that Pombiliti be offered through the National Health Service of England and Wales to people with relapsing remitting MS, meaning that Pombiliti will be available within the next 3 months at low or no cost through the NHS. And while we're talking about disease-modifying therapies, 2021 delivered really encouraging news from clinical trials evaluating a new category of DMTs called BTK inhibitors. You can expect to hear more about drugs like ublituximab, tolebrutinib, and evobrutinib in 2022. We got a little closer to identifying a biomarker for MS progression in 2021 when the International Progressive MS Alliance published a paper calling for a greater research focus on a specific protein called neurofilament light chain as a potential biomarker for MS progression. Identifying a biomarker for MS progression will lead to shorter clinical trials, which would make new treatments for progressive MS available sooner. And we couldn't close the books on our look back on last year without including telemedicine in our discussion. At the ACTRIMS meeting, that's the Americas Committee for Treatment and Research in MS, Dr. Mitchell Wallen of George Washington University presented the results of a survey that showed 76% of the MS specialists who responded to the survey had used telemedicine to see patients. And at the ECTRIMS meeting, that's the European Committee for Treatment and Research in MS, Dr. Marissa McGinley of the Cleveland Clinic presented evidence that showed that mixing telemedicine with office visits could produce the same outcomes as in-person MS care, which means that quality MS care could be made available to people with MS who are living in rural areas or to people who face logistical challenges just getting out of the house and to those office appointments. When I think back about these events that took place over the past year, I'm very happy to report that we talked about all of them on Real Talk MS. And it makes me even happier seeing so many of you come back every week to continue our conversation. So please consider this your personal invitation to join me each week in 2022 for more Real Talk MS. During my holiday break, I caught up with the last season of an Amazon Prime series called Goliath. The show stars Billy Bob Thornton as a hard-charging lawyer who sometimes colors outside the lines while he tilts at windmills, defending the little guy against big corporate interests, big government interests, or some other seemingly invincible opponent. Each season features a new case and a new challenge for our main character. And in this fourth and final season, we see our hero take on Big Pharma, but the thing that got my attention, and the thing I found really upsetting, is in this season of Goliath, one of the main characters is a woman who's supposed to be living with MS. And I should mention that this character seems to deal with mobility issues and fatigue issues in a very authentic way, the way that someone with MS would deal with those symptoms. But they don't get everything right. And my problem is in one of the first few episodes, this character explains that when she was diagnosed with MS, her doctor gave her 3 years to live. Of course, that doesn't happen. And this bothered me because people who don't know any better will simply assume that misrepresentation is true. I mean, why would the producers lie? So it worried me that someone who saw this show, and then maybe a couple of years later, that same person is diagnosed with MS, they might unnecessarily worry that their days are numbered and they're facing a death sentence. And I guess this bothered me more because it made me start to think about where we get our information. Over the past year, one of the phrases that's popped up frequently on this podcast was shared decision-making, the practice of a patient and a physician arriving at a collaborative decision regarding that patient's treatment plan. I've found shared decision-making to be empowering. It definitely changes the relationship dynamic between a patient and a healthcare provider, and I think it creates better healthcare outcomes, because it's much more likely that someone's going to stay on a treatment plan that they've been involved in choosing. Call it pride of authorship. Shared decision-making is a practice that continues to gain traction. But I think it's important to recognize that for shared decision-making to really work, it requires an informed patient. You can't have a conversation with your neurologist about different disease-modifying therapies if you don't know anything about disease-modifying therapies. Now, this doesn't mean you need a medical degree, but it means that you have some homework to do. And that brings us back to this question about where we get our information. If shared decision-making is something that's going to continue to find its way into more and more doctors' offices, then it becomes more important than ever to make sure that patients are getting our information from credible, reliable sources. I guess this is a big deal to me because I'm someone who shares information with the MS community every single week. And when I'm considering which topics I'm going to talk about with you, it always comes down to one thing: show me the evidence. And I try to be transparent about that. When I share the results of a clinical trial with you, I always provide a link to those published results in that episode's show notes. I want to be 100% clear that if I say something has been shown to be good for people with MS, whether that something is meditation or exercise, or it's a new disease-modifying therapy that's been approved by the FDA, I want you to know that there's real science backing up that statement. But there are plenty of other places you can visit on the internet where the information isn't always as helpful or as credible as it needs to be. And that worries me. A few months ago, I was contacted by a company that had launched a website designed to crowdsource the best treatments for a whole variety of chronic illnesses, including MS. In other words, they were inviting people living with chronic illness to visit their website and indicate the best treatment for their illness. Other people who might also be living with the same illness could visit this website and benefit from the hive mind when it came to deciding their best course of treatment. So far, this website claims to have 2.4 million registered members who have shared 66.3 million data points covering 612 different conditions. Those are impressive numbers. Now let me share with you the top three treatments for MS, according to over 11,000 contributors on this website. Number three is taking vitamins. Number two is exercise. And number one is making dietary changes. These are all healthy options, and they'll all have a positive impact on your quality of life. But how are disease-modifying therapies not the number one option? Or the number two option? Or at least number three? Perhaps many of these 11,000 well-meaning contributors don't understand that because MS is a chronic condition, you have to play the long game, which means knowing that there are treatment choices that you make today that are most likely going to deliver significant benefits years from now. Someone visiting this website, someone recently diagnosed with MS and wanting to educate themselves about their treatment options, might easily decide that diet, exercise, and vitamins are their best options. And when it comes to choosing their treatment plan, this person's ability to responsibly participate in shared decision-making with their neurologist is going to be limited by the quality of the information they've received. Now, I don't want to make it sound as though I'm picking on one particular website. You can visit any number of Facebook groups for people living with MS, and you'll find examples of the same question being posted over and over again. My neurologist has recommended, fill in the blank here, does anyone have any experience with this medication? It's a reasonable question, but the answer to this question has to be filtered through the understanding that just like MS impacts different people differently, medications also impact different people differently. When someone shares their experience with a particular disease-modifying therapy, they often don't mention how long they've been living with MS, how old they are, whether they happen to be obese or have diabetes or high blood pressure or other comorbidities, yet all of this information will have had an impact on their disease course and their experience with any medication. Too often, we forget to consider all of these things when we read someone's social media post. Because MS is an unpredictable disease, it's easy to sometimes feel as if you don't have control over your own life. Shared decision-making is empowering. It gives you back some of that control, and it makes you a full partner in treatment decisions, which can lead to higher levels of adherence, which can lead to better outcomes for you. And when it comes to our healthcare, if each of us is going to be a good partner in shared decision-making, doing our own research is important. And finding credible, trusted sources of information is what's going to make that personal research meaningful. I like to think this podcast can be one of those sources of information for you. The National MS Society can certainly be at the top of that list of trusted sources. And if you're looking for information and don't know where to look, don't be afraid to ask your neurologist, "Where can I learn more about this?" When it comes to living with MS, it's the very best question you can ask. And if one of your questions happens to be, how can I keep my New Year's resolution to eat healthier, or exercise regularly, or quit smoking, or any one of 100 other changes for the better, Dr. Brooks Wingo has some ideas and strategies that can help. In a moment, we'll meet my guest, Dr. Brooks Wingo. For a lot of us, the new year represents a fresh start and a new opportunity to create healthy habits. And by now, I think we've learned that resolutions are much easier to make than to keep. After just a few months, we often find ourselves settling back into the same old patterns, making the same choices that we always have. Well, my guest today is Dr. Brooks Wingo, and we're talking about ways that we can change our behavior and stick to our goals throughout the year. Dr. Wingo is an associate professor at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, in the Department of Occupational Therapy, and she's the principal investigator and director of the Health Behavior and Disability Lab. Happy New Year, and welcome to the podcast, Dr. Wingo.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Since we're talking about fixing bad habits, why do we habitually do this to ourselves? Why do people make these resolutions at the start of a new year?
That's a great question. So I think part of it is a lot of times we set resolutions, but we don't set goals to go along with them. So we kind of have this vague, you know, this is my year. I'm going to lose weight. I'm going to quit smoking. I'm going to get out of debt. I'm going to do all of these things. But we don't really have a good action plan to back them up. So that's one thing. The second reason I think a lot of us fail with when we try to change our behaviors is we live in an environment that's really not conducive to a lot of the health behaviors that we need to do. So we work long hours. We don't sleep very well. We have high stress levels. That's kind of what our culture, at least in the U.S., really kind of focuses on. We don't have a good society that really focuses on walkability and getting people physically active and reducing stress and eating fruits and vegetables. So that's part of it too, is if you're trying to change what's already a difficult behavior to change and you're doing it in an environment that's not conducive to change, it's going to be a little more difficult even.
If you had to name three resolutions that would benefit someone who's living with MS, what would they be?
That's a great question. I would say three resolutions. I would say three behaviors related that you want to improve would be diet, exercise, and sleep. And I think of all of those, people probably think of sleep the least, especially thinking of sleep as something that we can really, you know, change very well. But I think, you know, across the board, diet, exercise, and sleep are three behaviors that we're finding more and more are going to directly impact people with MS. As far as, you know, the physical outcomes, you're going to feel better, less pain, less fatigue. There's also some indication that there will be cognitive improvement, as well as mood. So depression, we know, obviously is very common among people with MS. But in general, depression and mood are helped by physical activity, especially, but also by sleep. So I think if I had to pick three, especially for MS, I would say diet, exercise, and sleep.
I think we already started talking about this a minute ago, but despite the best of intentions, we know that most New Year resolutions seem to end up as distant memories by March or April.
Yep.
What happens there? Why is it so difficult to stick to a new behavior over the long term?
Yeah, so I think if you look at research of behavior change, the people who are successful in picking up new behaviors or stopping bad behaviors, stopping behaviors and keeping them, they're the people who have been really intentional about the way they've done it. So again, not saying I'm going to lose weight this year. How are you going to lose weight? How much are you going to lose? How are you going to do it? When do you want to do it by? You know, I'm going to eat healthier. I get that one a lot. I'm going to eat healthier this year. What does that mean? Right. So I think if you're really intentional in setting up goals and setting up action plans and backup action plans, you're going to be much more successful. And so I think a lot of times, especially when it comes to New Year's resolutions, we say what we want, but then we don't make a plan for them. And so, like you said, by February, March, if we're lucky, you know, they're out the window.
Do you have some tips or strategies that we might be able to use that can help us stay on track in adopting a new behavior this year?
Yeah. So the first thing I always say is make sure you know what you want to do and why you're doing it. So again, if you want to lose weight, that's great. How much do you want to lose? Do you want to lose 5 pounds? Do you want to lose 50 pounds? And then figuring out why you want to do that. Because if you've gotten why you want to do it, a lot of times that's what we can fall back on when we start to get off track and we don't want to continue with what we're doing. I'm tired. I don't want to go to the gym today, right? But if I can remember why I'm going to the gym in the first place, because I want to improve my cognitive function and decrease my pain, so that ultimately I can play with my grandkids and be really active in life, that's going to be the motivator that kind of keeps you going. So know what you want to do and why. I also say make sure, again, goals, you've got some really clearly delineated, very specific but attainable goals. And then have a plan and a backup plan, because we all know that as much as we, you know, like you said, we have the greatest of intentions, but most of the time those don't carry through. So making sure that we have a plan and making sure that we have a backup plan, because we know that whatever's happened in the past is probably going to happen again. It's going to rain at some point. So that walk outside is not going to be able to happen at some point. So what are you going to do on the days where it does rain if you can't do your outside walk? You know, those kind of backup plans, I think those are really what's going to help get you through to the sustainable piece.
You know, I've always found that it's easier to stay on track when you see that you're making progress in your plan. And I'm wondering if there are any apps that can help track progress and help someone reach a particular goal.
Absolutely. Yeah. So tracking is huge. Tracking has been found in multiple behaviors, whether it be diet, smoking, exercise. Tracking is really key so that you can not only see what you're doing and how well you're doing. Success breeds success. So like you say, if you start seeing results, you know, you can figure out what you're doing well that's working. It also can help you figure out what's not working well that maybe you need to tweak a little bit. So for diet and exercise, MyFitnessPal and MyCalorieCounter are good ones. They're free, and they have a good database for foods, especially, and for physical activity. There's also a number of habits. There's one called Streak, I believe. They're habit tracking. So let's say you want to quit smoking. Basically, all you're doing is you go in there, you put your goal, And then you just every day it'll send you an update. Did you meet your goal today? Did you not? Did you do your behavior? Did you not do your behavior? And so then you can sit back and look at that calendar and you can start seeing how many, you know, little indications of how many green dots do you have to see just how great you're doing. That's really helpful for motivation too, because when you are feeling down, you're feeling like you're not doing very well. If you can go into that app, or even if you do it on a paper calendar and see how well you actually are doing and give yourself some credit for it, then it helps you kind of continue on.
We know that there are some habits that are a little tougher to break than others, and others that are worth picking up, but there are obstacles in the way. Let's talk about a couple of those. And the one that comes to mind is the one you just mentioned. We know that if you quit smoking, it's better for everyone, but it is particularly beneficial for someone who has MS. But quitting smoking is not easy. What makes that so hard?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Smoking is a really, really difficult behavior to stop. There's part of it is the addictive quality of tobacco and the nicotine that's going to make it even more difficult, right? So a lot of things go into that. So you have, how long have you been smoking? That's going to be part of it. So if you've been smoking for 6 months, it's going to be easier to stop than if you've been smoking for 20 years. So part of it, you know, you've got that addictive quality, but also you have most people who are trying to stop have been doing it for a number of years. So it's a really, really ingrained behavior. And so that's part of the reason. The other thing is there's a lot of options out there for treatment and for stopping smoking. And so you have to find the one that works for you, right? So it's just like any diet could work as long as you follow it. Any exercise program could work as long as you follow it. What's going to be the best option for you for stopping smoking? And sometimes it takes several tries to find a program that actually works for you and to keep you smoke-free.
Now let's talk about diet for a moment. Another very popular resolution at the beginning of the year that's also challenging. And part of the reason it's challenging is it means usually making a switch from a lot of junk food and fast food to healthier foods. And that requires spending more time in the kitchen as opposed to the drive-through line. So when you make that commitment to do that, and you're living with MS, and you come home from a day at work, or even when you're not at work, but all of a sudden you are overtaken by fatigue, the idea of stepping into the kitchen and putting a meal together doesn't sound particularly doable. What can people do to help themselves and overcome some of those fatigue issues in choosing to make better choices when it comes to food preparation?
Yeah, that's a really important barrier that a lot of people face. A lot of people with MS face is fatigue specifically. Like you said, I just want to go through a drive-thru because I don't want to cook. So one of the key strategies that we use for this is kind of prepping ahead. We call it meal prep. It's kind of bulk cooking almost. So think about things, especially like soup, being, you know, winter, cold weather, chili. You know, chili is something that you can make that's really kind of hearty. It fills you up, but it's, you know, full of veggies. You can make it relatively healthy. So you can make a big pot of chili and it freezes really well. Most soups freeze well also. So you can think about doing things like that when you are feeling good. Prep ahead soups and chilies and things like that can freeze well. The other thing you can do is bulk prep of like protein. So say you were going to do chicken and maybe pork of some sort or something like that. You can cook, you know, a big bulk of that, say on a weekend or whenever is your kind of off day, and you can eat off of it for several days. So having things like that are healthy alternatives that what you know that you should be eating, but that are not typically the easy grab and go. If you can make those grab and go for yourself, you're going to be a lot more likely to stay in the kitchen and out of the drive-thru.
Now let's tackle that third big goal for a lot of people, and that's exercise. Exercise has been shown to be particularly beneficial to people who are living with MS at every level of ability. And once again, fatigue, it's kind of a paradox, because I've read evidence that shows that exercise helps better manage MS fatigue. Of course, if you're feeling that fatigue, you're not necessarily feeling like exercising. So how do we overcome that?
Yeah, that's It is definitely a paradox, because if I'm tired, I don't want to exercise, but you're telling me my exercise is going to help my, it doesn't make sense. Right. So, you know, there's a lot of things when it comes to physical activity. I think the biggest thing, and I would say this for any behavior, is start small, right? So, it's probably not going to help your fatigue if you have not been doing any exercise and now you decide to go run 3 miles. Like, that's not what you want to do. Give yourself permission to start small, especially for folks with MS trying to manage pain, trying to manage fatigue. It's really important that you start small and then increase gradually. So a walk is perfectly fine. Like, there's nothing to say. Some people say, all I can do is walk. That's great. Go for a walk. If you start with 10 minutes, that's 10 minutes more than you were doing. So you can do 10 minutes. And then as you feel good with 10 minutes, go to 12 minutes. Once 12 minutes is okay, go to 15 minutes. The other thing that you can do that kind of helps with fatigue is break it up. So if you're trying to get in 30 minutes of physical activity throughout the day, it doesn't have to be 30 straight minutes. You can do 10 minutes in the morning, 10 minutes at lunch, 10 minutes in the evening. There's 30 minutes of cumulative physical activity, but it hasn't been overly taxing at any one point.
We know that change doesn't always come easy, but making changes that improve your quality of life are the kinds of changes that can make a real difference to someone who's living with MS. If someone needs additional support in changing old behaviors that aren't really working for them, what type of professional can help coach or guide someone through that process?
So definitely, if you're thinking about diet or nutrition, you're going to be looking for a registered dietitian. For exercise, you're going to be looking for someone with an exercise science background or some other kind of fitness training, whether that be personal trainer. I would say there are a number of specialty certifications for people who are doing exercise training, not specifically with MS per se, but with any kind of physical disability, especially gait impairment, mobility impairment. And they can really help you kind of tweak the program so that, you know, you're not doing too much too fast or something like that. If you're thinking about cigarette smoking or kind of smoking, other things like that, a substance abuse counselor, licensed psychologist, someone like that. There are a lot of health coaches that are coming up. There are certified health educators. They're going to be really good at helping for kind of across the board behaviors. But again, you just kind of want to look at the credentials and make sure that there's somebody who really knows what they're talking about when it comes to whatever behavior it is.
Well, Dr. Brooks Wingo, thanks for all that you do to improve the lives of people living with MS. And thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/227. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or text. And if you haven't gotten around to it yet, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes, and it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. So I hope you'll take a moment and download the app today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.